Usually, when you look at a massive solid object, there's this, fundamental expectation of stillness. Like you look at a steel I-beam holding up a skyscraper, or even just the chassis of your car, and it just looks like a frozen, permanent block of metal. It feels reassuringly static.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we build our entire physical world on that exact assumption. We need our structural materials to be predictable. And that creates this illusion that steel is just this finished, dormant product by the time it reaches a construction site.
But the moment you zoom in, right, down past the microscopic level and into the actual atomic lattice itself, that solid beam is, well, it's anything but still. That seemingly permanent block of metal is actually this chaotic, ongoing battlefield.
Yeah, it's a state of constant atomic tension. You've got carbon and iron atoms trapped in this microscopic war for stability. They're continuously pushing, pulling, and subtly rearranging themselves under just immense structural pressure.
And that invisible war zone is exactly what we're getting into on this deep dive. Today, our mission is to decode the hidden architecture of steel. We're going straight into the deep end of metallurgical quantum mechanics, looking at bainite crystallography, the bizarre anomalies of transition carbides, and the cutting-edge atomic math that dictates how these metals behave.
Right, and we aren't just going to catalog what these microscopic structures are. We're going to tear them apart to understand the why. We're looking at why a fraction of a nanometer shift in an atomic grid dictates whether that suspension bridge you're driving over stands strong or, shatters completely without warning.
It is genuinely wild to realize that the macrophysical world is entirely at the mercy of these microscopic geometric cheat codes. But to understand how modern engineers manipulate advanced steel, we first need to understand what happens naturally when you just like throw iron and carbon into a forge together. What is the ultimate end game for those atoms once the metal starts cooling down?
So the ultimate end game, the thermodynamic happy place for carbon inside steel, is a highly stable compound called cementite. Chemically, that's a perfectly organized ratio of three iron atoms for every one carbon atom, Fe3C.
Okay.
When a piece of steel cools and transforms into everyday microstructures like lower bainite or tempered martensite, the carbon desperately wants to precipitate out of the chaos and settle into that stable cementite structure.
But it doesn't just magically jump straight to that perfect 3-to-1 ratio, right? The atoms don't just instantly snap into their forever homes. The steel goes through these awkward, highly unstable teenage phases first.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Those teenage phases are what metallurgists call transition carbides. Instead of going straight to cementite, the carbon and iron form temporary stopgap structures, specifically eta, chi, and epsilon carbides. They act as stepping stones.
And when you look at high-resolution electron microscopy of these transition phases forming, the physical reality is just mind-blowing. There's this phenomenon called microsyntactic intergrowth.
Oh, yeah, microsyntactic intergrowth is fascinating.
Right. Because at first glance, under the microscope, it just looks like a flawed or broken chunk of cementite. But when you crank the magnification up to the atomic level, you realize it's actually an incredibly intricate alternating stack. It's interpenetrating layers of stable cementite and an unstable intermediate called chi carbide.
And that chi carbide layer is an absolute chemical mess. It has a non-stoichiometric formula written mathematically as Fe2n plus 1 Cn.
Which means there's no clean whole number ratio. It's just a fractional chaotic blend.
Exactly. You have these crystal planes of chi carbide packed directly parallel to the planes of cementite. But because their chemical ratios are different, their atomic spacing is different. The chi carbide planes are spaced 0.57 nanometers apart, while the cementite is 0.67 nanometers.
So it's like a microscopic millefeuille, like a layered pastry. You have these incredibly thin layers stacked intimately on top of each other, but the layers don't quite match in size.
Right, they're slightly mismatched.
But here's the mechanism I really want to figure out. The text says these mixed layered particles eventually dissolve completely. They break themselves down to form solid, stable, globular chunks of cementite, usually migrating out to the edges or grain boundaries of the metal. Why do they go through this complicated, layered pastry phase just to destroy themselves later? Like, why not just build the globular cementite from the start?
Well, what's fascinating here is that it all comes down to how atoms physically move through a solid block of iron. And specifically, it's about the buildup of strain energy. When these initial layered particles form, they do so through what's called a displacive transformation.
Meaning they aren't just floating through a liquid to find a spot. They actually have to push through solid metal.
Precisely. In a displacive transformation, the atoms shift and distort the existing iron lattice in a highly coordinated, almost military-style movement. Entire planes of atoms slide diagonally together. Imagine trying to force a square peg into a slightly smaller square hole, not by shaving the peg down, but by violently shoving it in so the hole bulges outward. You build up an immense amount of physical strain and tension in the surrounding iron.
So structurally speaking, the metal is just agonizingly stretched. It's holding a tremendous amount of mechanical stress just to keep that particle in place.
Exactly. And that physical agony actually becomes the battery that powers the next step. The lattice is so highly strained that it creates an enormous energetic driving force. That built-up tension eventually forces the atoms to literally tear themselves out of that strained pastry structure and rebuild themselves one by one.
Moving from that displacive shoving match to reconstructive growth.
Yes, reconstructive growth. That's where atomic bonds actually break, and the atoms diffuse individually to build a new shape, that globular cementite that permanently relieves the pressure.
Okay, let's unpack this, because if strain energy is the invisible engine dictating how these transition phases behave, we really have to look at the most strained, peculiar, and frankly bizarre transition phase of all,
yeah.
Epsilon carbide.
Epsilon is geometrically fascinating precisely because of how badly it distorts its environment.
It really is an architectural nightmare. Epsilon has a hexagonal close-packed iron arrangement. And again, its chemical formula isn't a clean integer. It's roughly Fe2.4C.
Right.
And when you look at where the carbon atoms actually sit inside this iron structure, they hide in these tiny gaps called octahedral interstices, specifically a geometric location known as the second Wyckoff sites.
Yeah, to visualize a second Wyckoff site, imagine the iron atoms forming a dense three-dimensional honeycomb. The carbon atoms have to basically squeeze into the tiny hollow gaps within that honeycomb. But carbon atoms strongly repel each other.
Right. They adopt this very specific mathematical arrangement called P6322 symmetry, which is just a complicated way of saying they arrange themselves like tenants in a poorly built apartment building who absolutely refuse to share a wall, a ceiling, or a floor with another tenant. They stagger themselves at perfect diagonals to maximize the distance between one another.
It's a great analogy, but deliberately staggering themselves that way forces the surrounding iron honeycomb to stretch unnaturally. Creating this specific epsilon crystal requires massive principal deformations.
The eigenvalues, right?
Exactly. The eigenvalues, which physicists use to measure exactly how much the lattice has to stretch in three dimensions, are huge. Because that distortion is so punishing, epsilon physically cannot grow large. It is self-limiting. It can only survive as an incredibly fine nanoparticle. If it gets too big, the strain simply tears the crystal apart from the inside.
But wait, let me push back on that logic for a second. If forcing this epsilon structure into existence requires such an agonizing, violent deformation for the crystal, why does the carbon even bother? We know from the sources that every piece of steel has structural flaws naturally built in tiny tears in a lattice called dislocations.
Sure, dislocations are everywhere in steel.
Right. And the binding energy of a carbon atom to a normal structural flaw dislocation is 0.5 electron volts. In atomic terms, that is a massive magnetic pull. Why doesn't the carbon just hide in the existing defects instead of torturing the lattice to build an epsilon nanoparticle?
I love that you brought that up, because that is the exact spatial reasoning that unlocks how these metals behave in the real world. The short answer is the carbon absolutely does prefer to hide in the dislocations. It takes the path of least resistance.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It is energetically much cheaper to just sit comfortably in a pre-existing tear in the steel than to force the creation of epsilon.
It's like finding a pre-dug hole instead of having to excavate one yourself.
Exactly. Think of those dislocations like parking spaces in a very small, very crowded lot. The carbon atoms will flood into those parking spaces first, but eventually the lot reaches absolute capacity. Epsilon carbide only forms when the carbon concentration in the steel is so high that every single parking space in the metal is completely full.
Ah, so epsilon is purely a spillover effect. It's just the carbon that has nowhere else to go.
Yes. The thermodynamic math is definitive on this. If the carbon concentration drops below 0.2 weight percent at a given dislocation density, epsilon simply will not form, period. Every single carbon atom will comfortably hide inside a structural flaw. You only see epsilon in higher carbon steels where the carbon is fundamentally evicted from the normal lattice, so it has no choice but to group together and force these highly strained, awkward nanoparticles into existence.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Since epsilon only forms under highly specific, strained conditions, you'd think metallurgists could easily prevent it from forming by throwing in other elements. And they try. A major tool they use is silicon.
Silicon is deeply important for modern advanced materials, particularly in trip-assisted steels. TRIP stands for transformation-induced plasticity.
Which is the steel used in modern car bodies to absorb crash impacts, right?
Right. In those specialized steels, engineers intentionally add silicon to completely stop that final stable phase, cementite, from forming. If you stop the cementite, you keep the carbon dissolved in the surrounding microscopic structures, which essentially keeps the steel remarkably flexible while remaining strong.
But when they pump the steel full of silicon, they hit this massive, baffling paradox. The silicon successfully stops the cementite, which is great. But instead of preventing the intermediate phases, it massively supercharges the formation of the unstable epsilon carbide. It throws epsilon production into absolute overdrive.
This raises an important question. Does silicon actually make the epsilon carbide more chemically stable? Because if you look at the fundamental rules of thermodynamics, the answer is a resounding definitive no.
Right, because when quantum physicists actually run the ab initio calculations, meaning they build a mathematical model of the metal from the absolute first principles of quantum mechanics, they find that thermodynamically, silicon utterly despises epsilon.
The atomic repulsion is incredibly strong.
If you mathematically try to force a silicon atom to substitute into the epsilon lattice, the computer returns a massive energy penalty of plus 48.4 kilojoules per mole. That is essentially a thermodynamic brick wall. The universe is saying this bond should not exist.
Exactly.
So thermodynamics says absolutely not. But it forms anyway. It's like trying to force a puzzle piece into the wrong spot, but somehow it goes in faster than ever. If thermodynamics says no, but it happens anyway, there must be some sort of kinetic loophole, right? Like taking a really bumpy, dangerous shortcut through the woods just because the smooth, stable highway is jammed with traffic.
That's a perfect way to frame it. It is the classic battle between thermodynamics and kinetics. Thermodynamics dictates the ideal final resting state of the energy. It tells us what the absolute most stable configuration should be at the end of time. But kinetics dictates the speed, the pathway, and the immediate reality of getting there. And silicon provides a brilliant microscopic kinetic cheat code.
How does it actually bypass that 48 kilojoule penalty, though?
It does it purely through geometry. While the silicon makes the crystal thermodynamically miserable physically, its presence causes a tiny, almost imperceptible 0.5% contraction along the epsilon crystal's vertical C-axis.
Half of 1%. That is a vanishingly small squeeze.
Yeah.
Why does silicon cause it to contract?
Well, because silicon atoms are a different size and carry a different electron cloud than iron or carbon. When you force them into the general vicinity, they crowd the local atomic real estate. To accommodate that crowding, the epsilon lattice has to slightly compress itself to fit.
And why does that tiny squeeze suddenly allow epsilon to form so fast?
Because of what that half percent contraction achieves. It allows the outer edges of the epsilon nanoparticle to perfectly, seamlessly align with the atomic grid of the surrounding martensite steel. We call this achieving coherency. Imagine two different brick walls meeting at a corner. Usually the bricks don't quite line up, so you have to waste a ton of mortar and energy forcing them together. But that tiny 0.5% squeeze accidentally makes the bricks line up flawlessly.
So the energy required to actually bridge the two materials drops to zero.
Exactly. Because it suddenly fits so perfectly into the surrounding matrix, the kinetic energy barrier to physically nucleate the particle virtually disappears. It can form almost instantly. So even though it is thermodynamically unstable and wants to tear itself apart, it nucleates so aggressively and locks into the surrounding structure so snugly that kinetics completely overrules thermodynamics.
Speed and geometric fit beat chemical stability. That is a phenomenal illusion.
It really is.
So what does this all mean? We've solved the microscopic mystery of why epsilon forms. But how does this atomic-level kinetic cheat affect the macro world? Why should someone listening to this, someone driving a car or crossing a bridge, actually care?
You care because when silicon accidentally spawns a swarm of epsilon carbide nanoparticles inside your steel, it drastically alters the physical properties of the material you're trusting with your life. It fundamentally changes how the metal absorbs energy, how it bends, and crucially, how it breaks.
Yeah, the sources get into this. When you actually test how Epsilon reacts to real-world pressure, you find something startling about its elastic moduli. Unlike cementite, the Young's modulus, which measures pure stiffness of Epsilon, actually exceeds that of pure iron.
Right.
But the truly critical metric that dictates how a material fails is the shear modulus divided by the bulk modulus, the ES over B ratio.
And that ratio is basically the holy grail for material scientists. The shear modulus measures how well a material resists its atomic planes sliding past one another. The bulk modulus measures how well it resists being squeezed or compressed from all sides.
Right. And the mathematical balance between sliding and squeezing predicts whether a material is malleable, meaning it will bend and dent under pressure, or brittle, meaning it will absorb energy until it catastrophically snaps. Cementite, for all its immense strength, has an ES over B ratio of 0.33. That is low enough that it allows the cementite to deform plastically.
Which is an incredible property. It means the carbide bends with the iron. It's exactly how we can manufacture ultra-high-strength pyrolytic steel ropes for suspension bridges. The cementite stretches and flows without cracking.
But Epsilon? Epsilon's ratio is a massive 0.48.
Which is exceptionally dangerously high for a metal carbide inside a structural steel.
So cementite is like a stiff but bendable plastic. But Epsilon is much closer to glass. If I'm building a car chassis, I definitely don't want glass spontaneously forming and locking up the internal structure of my metal. It sounds like a pure liability. Is there any way to actually use Epsilon, or is it just a nuisance that engineers have to constantly fight against?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, understanding the exact atomic mechanism that makes it a liability is the key to turning it into an asset. Yes, uncontrolled Epsilon is brutally brittle. The microscopic data shows that if those Epsilon particles are allowed to grow to about 200 nanometers, it completely ruins the toughness of the steel. It causes catastrophic embrittlement. But because we now have these quantum models, we aren't flying blind. We can actively design around the flaw.
We can manipulate the chemistry to change the rules.
Precisely. Remember how silicon made Epsilon thermodynamically unstable but kinetically fast? The ab initio models reveal a fascinating counter-discovery. Adding manganese does the exact opposite. Manganese atoms actively lower the formation energy of Epsilon by an astonishing minus 31.2 kilojoules per mole.
Wait, really? So by injecting manganese, you aren't just relying on a kinetic loophole anymore. You actually make the Epsilon thermodynamically stable.
Yes. You completely flip the script. By altering the local chemistry with manganese, Epsilon stops being a fleeting, unstable teenage phase desperately trying to dissolve and becomes the final, permanent destination.
You literally turn a bug into a feature.
Exactly. And that opens up an entirely new frontier for material science. If engineers can control the precise size of the particles, keeping them incredibly small, and use manganese to make them permanently stable, they can harness that massive glass-like stiffness without triggering the catastrophic brittleness that usually comes with it. It creates a playground for designing specialized manganese-rich alloys that have never existed before.
It really is a profound journey when you look at it from end to end. I mean, we started by looking at a supposedly static, permanent block of steel, only to find a microscopic war zone. We decoded the messy layered pastries of Qi and cementite intergrowth, realizing that the sheer agony of physical strain energy is the battery that drives the metal's evolution.
And we tracked the carbon atoms desperately hunting for pre-existing parking spaces in the crystal's flaws, only resorting to building Epsilon when they were totally evicted by overcrowding.
Right. And we saw how a 0.5% geometric contraction, just atomic crowding caused by a silicon atom, can create a coherency loophole that completely bypasses the fundamental laws of thermodynamics, resulting in a brittle, glass-like nanoparticle secretly hiding inside your metal. It completely changes how you look at the engineered world around you.
It reveals how fragile the line between strength and failure really is.
But I want to leave you with one final provocative thought, drawn straight from the inherent constraints of the scientific research itself. Those ab initio quantum calculations we talked about, the ones that finally solved the silicon paradox and proved the existence of the kinetic cheat code.
Yeah.
To make the math work, those supercomputer models were strictly run assuming a temperature of absolute zero and a physical pressure of zero.
Yeah, it is the only way our current computational power can isolate and calculate those specific quantum forces without the chaotic noise of thermal energy.
Right. But steel is not forged at absolute zero in a vacuum. It is born in roaring, white-hot furnaces, and it operates under the massive real-world stress of holding up skyscrapers and absorbing car crashes. If a tiny 0.5% atomic contraction in a frozen zero-Kelvin computer simulation can completely rewrite the rules of metallurgy, what other impossible kinetic illusions are happening inside our metals at 2,000 degrees? What other ghost particles are forming, warping, and dissolving in the extreme heat, just waiting for our quantum models to finally catch up and see them?
It definitely makes you wonder if we have even scratched the surface of the physics actually happening inside the forge.
We might just be measuring the shadows. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the invisible structures hidden in plain sight, and remember, nothing is ever quite as still as it seems.